Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Cooper Talks USA, and this week I'm going to be looking at the issue of elections and asking why they cost so much. Obviously, you'll probably know by now that American presidential elections and congressional elections, in fact elections at all levels, are open to a number of criticisms: the length of time, the two-party dominance and so on. But one of the biggest criticisms is how much they cost. And let's just put that into some perspective. In the 2010 general election, the combined spending of all the parties for the 650 seats in Westminster came to about £30 million. And in 2015, that figure had risen for all the parties, all 650 constituencies, in a very competitive election. The total cost was £45.5 million. Now that is just for the general election every 5 years. The total cost for the 2014 congressional midterms in America was $4 billion. And in a presidential election year in 2012, the total cost was $7 billion, just under $7 billion, as estimated by the FEC. This is a vast amount of money, far more than we're used to in Britain. And in some ways, we might say that makes sense. We might look, obviously, America is a much bigger country with many more people, approximately 314 million voters, as opposed to about 40 million voters in the UK. But the sheer scale of it is unlike anything we're used to, not just in Britain, but in most places around the world. And we need to consider why exactly American presidential elections cost so much, as well as the implications these have for democracy in the States. Now, the most obvious criticism of the cost is the effect of Citizens United. And the Citizens United ruling obviously allowed unlimited spending by independent organisations, the super PACs. And of course, this has led to a change in American politics, and it has led to more campaigning. But that only allows more spending. It doesn't explain why the elections should cost quite so much. And actually, while Citizens United has changed things, on its own, it doesn't explain the rising costs. If you go back to 1998, it was about just over $1.5 billion was spent on the congressional races. 2000, again, before the Citizens United ruling, the combined total with the presidential and congressional races was just over $3 billion. 2004, presidential election race, it had risen to more than $4 billion. In 2008, before Citizens United, the cost of the presidential and congressional races combined was over $5 billion. So actually, the 2012 spend of $7 billion on its own wasn't actually an exponential rise. It was a $2 billion more. That obviously is a major number. But presidential election costs had been rising anyway. Soft money spending, party spending, other contributions in the primaries, the unregulated spending, all of these had led to increasing costs. So it's unfair to blame Citizens United entirely for this, but it's more interesting to ask why. Why are the costs rising so much, and why is it so expensive to contest the elections? Now, the first thing I'm going to look at is one of the most important early steps, and that is ballot registration. Possibly not the most exciting issue in the world, and something that most people might overlook. Obviously, once you've got the presidential nomination for one of the two main parties, the main parties will then organise ballot initiatives to get you on the ballot in each of the states. But of course, with the rise of primaries, you have to take responsibility for your own campaign, and you have to make sure you get your name on the ballots for the primary votes in all the states that you're contesting. And this can be a very lengthy, very complicated, a very confusing process. As ever with America, each state has its own rules. Some are quite relaxed, others can be quite severe. And two states I just want to draw your attention to are the states of Illinois and Virginia. Now, Virginia's rules on the surface seem quite straightforward. You need to submit a petition of 5,000 signatures showing that at least 5,000 people of the millions that live in Virginia support your candidacy. However, there's two big problems there. One is you have to have had at least 200 signatures in each of the 11 congressional districts. And of course, some of those congressional districts have been heavily gerrymandered and are very much dominated by Democrat supporters and voters. And you've got to try and persuade at least 200 of those people to support your candidacy. And that can prove incredibly time-consuming and incredibly difficult. So it's not just the 5,000, it's the fact you have to get a certain number in each district. And this perhaps is where, for presidential candidates, the gerrymandering is having a significant consequence, because it's making it that much harder to pick up the necessary signatures in each district. Added to that is the fact that for Virginia, as with some other states, you have to submit your 5,000 signatures by December the 10th in 2015. Now, your candidacy might not be going anywhere, or you might have hopes that you'll win Iowa or do well in New Hampshire, and that will give you momentum and that will help you raise funds. But if you haven't already got on the ballot in Virginia by December, then you can't stand for the primary election when it comes round later on in the actual election year. And that was a problem that happened in 2012 when the Virginia primary came round at a point when the race for the Republican nomination was still very much up for grabs, and yet Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum were not on the ballot. The only two names, the only two people that had actually met the filing deadline were Romney and Rand Paul. So Romney won it, and he got a huge share of the delegates as a result. And that shows the problem here. In order to get 5,000 signatures, you need name recognition. You need to be seen as a viable candidate. And that may not happen until after Iowa and New Hampshire, until this time, February of the election year. But if you've not been able to submit the necessary signatures back in December or possibly even November the year before, then you won't be able to contest all 50 states. Added to this is the cost. To submit your petition with your 5,000 signatures, you have to pay the state legislature of Virginia $117,000. So you've got to pay more than $100,000 just to be able to submit your list of signatures. Now, when we're talking about the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent in presidential election campaigns, that might not seem like very much. But of course, if you're talking about $100,000 in all 50 states, then you're talking about $5 million before you do anything else. And if you're a Jeb Bush or a Hillary Clinton or a Mitt Romney or a Donald Trump, that in itself probably isn't an issue. But for the smaller campaigns, or the campaigns of people that are less well known and haven't yet had the opportunity to raise the finance, it can be a financial burden, and they may have to choose not to contest certain states. So that's partly where the costs come. Just filing, getting your name on the primary ballots in every state, that's going to be looking at $5 million at the start. Most people estimate somewhere between $1 or $2 million will actually be spent. Costs do vary across the states. But even that can be quite prohibitive. And some of the deadlines are very early, some of them are quite late. So there's obviously a mixture there. So just getting on the ballot, that explains some of the prohibitive costs and the reasons why a presidential election campaign is so expensive. Now, of course, assuming you've got the money to do the filing, you still need to go and get the signatures, and you've got to understand how each state works, which is more difficult than it seems. And this is where you need to employ people to help you. Traditionally, you would employ an experienced campaign operator. Again, this has to be done independently of the party. You have to pay this person from the money that you've raised. And they can charge millions for their services. An experienced operator who's got pedigree and big name reputation, has a proven track record that they can get people elected, they can charge a huge amount of money for their services, and obviously with no guarantee of a winning result at the end of it. But these people will have the expert knowledge of how to contest different elections. Now, if you're lucky, a pressure group or an organisation such as the Republican National Lawyers Association might produce a guidebook that they will allow the various candidates to use. But again, they might sell this, as they have done in the past. For 2016, they've actually allowed all the Republicans free access to this guide to explain the voting procedures. But again, campaign managers, organisers, to try and get you on the petition, to get you on the ballot, they can charge a huge amount of money. And it's not just them, it's the whole team, their offices and so on. So again, this is an added expense. And of course, with the regional variations where you have to say in Virginia, as well as in the state of Illinois, you have to get a certain number of signatures in each congressional district. And because of the rise of gerrymandering, this is becoming much more difficult. You can't just rely on some activist party faithfuls who might go around for you in a particular area gathering signatures. Obviously, name recognition helps there. But now you've got such gerrymandered districts, there maybe aren't any supporters for the Republicans in certain areas, or vice versa for the Democrats. And so how are you going to get the signatures there? Where are the activists coming from? Well, if you can't get activists, or you don't have a huge army ready to support you, you can, of course, pay an interest group or a lobby group who will organise this for you. Again, part of the campaign costs, and they will pay volunteers, so they're not really volunteers, but they pay them anyway and class them as volunteers, to go out gathering signatures for you. And this can be very hard work and can lead to huge costs as well. And this is a big worry for the 2016 candidates, because now we've got the heavily gerrymandered districts in Illinois. Districts in Chicago, which is heavily Democrat and very loyal to Obama, will not find many signatures or people willing to sign up to endorse any of the Republican candidates. So you could end up in a situation where maybe only one or two, possibly even none of the candidates get there. That's not quite true. As organisations like Jeb Bush and so on, I think Marco Rubio as well, and Ted Cruz, they've managed to get on the ballot there, but only after spending a vast amount of money finding possible signatures across Chicago, as well as in other parts of Illinois. And these are things that smaller campaigns like Carly Fiorina's, Lindsey Graham's and so on, just can't afford to do. This is one of the reasons why Bobby Jindal and Scott Walker have had to leave the race so early, because they just couldn't fund the attempts to get on the ballot, never mind the cost of filing all the ballots. So just getting your name on the ballot is prohibitively expensive. Now, of course, we might say that's a bad thing, because it tends to reward the rich, well-financed candidates. But again, what it helps to do is stop extremist candidates or those candidates that don't actually have the support or the ability to raise funds, which will be necessary for actually contesting a presidential election. So, yes, the costs are prohibitive, but in a way that might not be a bad thing. It might help limit the field. We started with more than 20 Republican candidates, and these prohibitive costs have already put off a number of those candidates, and it will mean some of these candidates won't be on the ballots, and that will weaken their ability to go through and contest the primary. So actually, it's expensive, but it's not necessarily a bad thing, and that's a good piece of assessment that you can use in a possible exam question. Now, probably the most obvious and the largest cost of any presidential campaign is the TV advertising. And there's two sides to this. Obviously, the cost of producing adverts is a major factor. You want something that's professional, you want something that's done well with actors, good graphics, good designs. These cost money, and you have to employ agencies as any other business would. And so there's that side to it. If you do one on the cheap, as Herman Cain found out with the famous smoking ad, it looks cheap and it actually negatively affects your campaign. So there's that cost. But a more interesting one is the cost of actually putting them on TV. And this is a huge, huge expense. And different candidates have different ways of working this system, and it can give a big advantage to some. Now, to look at to use an example here, I'm going to look at the differences between Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. As things stand, looking at TV ad purchase data, Bush will have spent about $5 million more than Rubio on broadcast ads on TV and radio across the four early voting states, so Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina and Nevada. So if money's win you election, you'd say, well, clearly Jeb Bush is going to win. He spent $5 million more than Marco Rubio. However, bizarrely, Bush will have fewer ads on TV in those four states than Marco Rubio. So why is that? Well, this is why Citizens United maybe hasn't made that huge difference. Most of Bush's ads have been paid for by his super PAC. And that's so the figures given by Politico are about 85% for Bush versus about 40% for Rubio. So the super PAC's buying money on their behalf. However, super PACs are not given favourable rates. They are treated as a business. And they're not given the same sort of discounts or considerations that the official campaign will have. And that's the difference. So in Iowa and New Hampshire, you end up paying about 1,000% more for a super PAC purchased ad than for a candidate purchased ad, which is a huge markup. And of course, that means even if the super PAC is spending millions more, it's undermining the effects. You have to keep spending a huge amount more just to try and keep pace with a candidate who's using his own official campaign finances to fund it. So super PACs might spend more, but that doesn't necessarily mean they get more. And that's the case. We're getting Marco Rubio is getting far more ads because he's able to buy them more cheaply because he's relying on the spending from his campaign. In addition to this, we should look at the sort of timings of some of these ads. Rubio, with his smaller spending, has managed to spend to get most of his ads, about 38% of it, to prime time ads, so ads likely to be seen by a huge number of people, whereas the Bush team only have about 20%. In fact, not just the Bush team, everyone else in the field. But again, there are some caveats with this. Rubio has secured the early advertising. He still needs to pay for it, so he still needs to raise money to pay for the ads that he's already booked. And equally, Bush's super PAC does still have millions in the bank, and they could end up spending even more. But it goes to show that part of the costs are because super PACs don't get the same sort of discounts as official campaigns do, and therefore securing TV advertising space costs more without actually delivering more advertising. So, yes, although costs have gone up exponentially over the last decade, and particularly since Citizens United, it's not guaranteed that it's actually leading to more television ads. So that's an important caveat and thing to remember. The other thing with this is, you know, part of the costs are putting on adverts for the actual presidential election in the key states. Now, states like New York, and especially swing states like Florida, have crowded television markets. It's all done by state. It's not really done on a national basis. So you pay for your advert within your state. And obviously, all the candidates, or both candidates in the presidential race, are competing for advertising space in somewhere like Florida, but they are competing against everyone else who wants TV advertising. They're competing against Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Burger King and Nike and Adidas and everyone else who wants to put their adverts on the news. And it's a competitive market, so the more free advertising space, the cheaper the costs. The more popular programs with more advertising space sold, they cost more. What's left costs more. Prices continue to go up. And so prices for candidates in these swing states, especially with more swing states now than we've had, say, in 2004 and 2000, means that the cost of getting the TV ads, just so you can put them on the TV at prime locations, are going up ever more. And it's also why an incumbent president has a significant advantage. Back in 2012, Obama knew he was running unopposed in the primaries. So he was able to lock in early advertising deals with the major TV networks. Now, because he'd paid for these in advance, he'd locked in the time slots before they got sold to all the different businesses that'd be competing for them, he managed to get a lot of high-quality ad space at a relatively cheap price. He got an early bird discount, so to speak. Now, because Romney had to keep fighting the primaries and wasn't sure he'd actually win the nomination until quite late on, he couldn't book this advertising space, had to wait until he was sure of the nomination, and then he had to book it. And of course, by that time, not only has Obama paid for his advertising space, but so have many other regular advertisers. So although much was made in 2012 that Romney spent more on TV advertising than Barack Obama, Obama actually got more TV adverts on the air, particularly in the swing states, particularly in those crucial weeks just before the election. And in some cases, Romney just could not get a primetime slot because they'd all been sold. So again, a lengthy primary campaign can lead to increasing costs when it comes to trying to book TV advertising space, which you can only really get a good discount on if you do it in advance. So again, something that might come to bear in the 2016 election is how long will the respective primary campaigns go on? If Hillary Clinton and the Democrats have it all sewn up before the end of February, then they can obviously get on with booking TV advertising, while if the Republicans are still fighting and taking each other apart all the way until, say, July, then their eventual nominee will have to spend much more money on advertising space. And of course, if you leave it to the super PACs, well, they might have billions to spend, but they're not going to get the same level of discount, and that could still be a massive disadvantage. So yes, costs have risen, but that doesn't necessarily mean there is more campaigning going on. In fact, in some ways, you could argue actually there's less TV campaigning going on as the market gets increasingly crowded. Does it matter? Well, if Romney and Rubio are getting more adverts for less money, then you'd suggest that actually the cost doesn't necessarily matter, because candidates can still outperform the wealthier, more well-funded campaigns. So it is a concern. Obviously, it is a huge expense that has to be met at some point. And just by having TV advertising and radio advertising in the USA, which we don't have in the UK, we're legally not allowed to have it in the UK, those costs do increase. And that's one of the reasons American presidential elections are so expensive, but it's not necessarily that the money is being well spent. A third factor to think about with why presidential elections in America, or any elections, cost so much, and why those costs have increased since 1998 or 2000, is the growing role of new media. Now, of course, TV advertising is still by far the most important. TV radio networks are still the most common tool. But since the 2000s, new technology, new social media have created a new avenue and a new means of campaigning, and one that a candidate ignores at their peril. Much was made of the Obama campaign's use of small donations, and of course, that wasn't quite how he made most of his money, but those small donations came in through the internet or through the phone banks. Now, you need to employ a systems operator, you need to have the website, you need to have the staff to be able to maintain and run this organisation. And again, you are competing with a lot of other organisations for that same media business or the media experts. And with Obama's campaign in 2012, the much vaunted system of internet targeting, of using Facebook, and of course his three main websites where he used Narwhal, Dashboard and Dreamcatcher for targeted advertising, not only did he have to run and administer these, but he had to actually pay for the technology to be created. And he does this in relation with Facebook and Amazon. But of course, it costs money. It took time to experiment and test it, making sure it could work before the election. And you have to pay these people. And these are software geniuses. They're not giving up their time for free. And you have to pay them to do this, as well as taking the time and the experiments to get it right. In addition to this, you have to have your people monitoring Twitter to see what's trending on Twitter. Famously in the 2012 presidential debates, Obama, actually, strictly speaking on the media, the first debate was okay. But he started getting panned on Twitter. And that created a self-fulfilling prophecy that he was actually losing it. He was doing really badly. And it came out looking bad because of Twitter. So you've got to pay people to monitor Twitter, to combat it with their own tweets. You've got to, I hate to break it to anyone who thinks this is what happens, but if Obama sends you a tweet, he's probably not the one who's actually written it. And again, all these messages cost money. You have to employ people to monitor them and go on. You could try and rely on volunteers, but for a lot of these strategies, you need experts, and experts cost money. In addition to this, you need to come up with a web page, and it needs to look professional and done well. People are not going to respect a presidential candidate who has a second-rate, homemade website that crashes all the time and doesn't work. You've got to try and make sure it's working. Again, you need to employ organizations who can run the website for you and who can set it up and make sure it works. In addition to this, we've obviously got the story of Rick Santorum, who had his slight Google problem. For those of you who don't know, how can I put it? Well, there had been a reference in Stranger magazine criticising Rick Santorum back in the days when he was a senator. Stranger magazine is a gay magazine, or a magazine for gay men, and he was Rick Santorum was described in it as, and I may get the exact quote slightly wrong, but that frothy matter, or that frothy mixture of lube and fecal matter that comes about as a result of anal sex. Now, the problem that Rick Santorum had is that that link, or that reference, is what generally came up whenever you entered Google and tapped Rick Santorum. So as Rick Santorum was trying to gain name recognition in the 2012 primaries, trying to get his name out there and meeting people or putting out adverts, people would go along to Google and they'd Google Rick Santorum, and then that would be one of the first things that came up, and they'd see it, and they probably wouldn't think kindly of Rick Santorum after that. So he asked Google to see if they would perhaps change it, and they said, no, it's our algorithm, it's how it works. So he then had to employ and pay people to try and sort of hit his name in a more positive way so that the reference to lube and fecal matter would be pushed down Google's list. Now, with Rick Santorum, that's quite a specific problem that he had. But again, it shows one of the increasing costs of the presidential election since 2000. You have to look at the internet. You have to look at what's coming up on Google searches or Bing or anywhere else that people might search as you're trying to get your name out there. The internet is a fantastic tool to get name recognition, to help get the volunteers, to get the signatures, to raise awareness and raise money. But it can also backfire. And trying to control the internet is impossible, but trying to manipulate it requires experts. And there is a whole industry now based around the lobbying, based around K Street in Washington, D.C., all geared to helping prospective election presidential or congressional candidates win election by improving their position on the internet. So again, these are other huge costs attributed with a presidential election campaign. Now, another thing that helps raise the costs of the elections is the increasing number of staff that you need to have. A campaign can go so far on volunteers, and usually a lot of the groundwork will be based on encouraging volunteers. But increasingly, in order to professionalise a campaign and make sure they can get out the vote, so it goes back to getting your team to go out and vote, candidates are having to employ staffers to work not only on their whole main campaign, but they have to also work in local state offices. If we went back to 2008, Obama was paying for about 200 staff, paid staff, in the state of Florida. This is from early summer 2008, even before he's actually officially been given the nomination. He had 90 in Michigan, which is set to go up to 200, and another 200 in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and even 50 in sort of Republican Missouri, with plans to expand there. And again, that staffing cost, you've got to pay the wages, you've got to provide the offices, and these all take a huge amount of money. And so this is why presidential election campaigns cost so much. Obama won in 2008 and 2012 partly because he had these local staffers who went around encouraging other volunteers who in turn would go around and encourage people to get out the vote. But if he hadn't had those paid staffers, he might not have had the level of support or the volunteers. It may have meant he wouldn't have got out the vote and wouldn't have won as a result. So it is now a necessity. You cannot rely on those. You can't rely on volunteers to help you. You're going to have to pay for it. And of course, people with experience or expertise are going to charge more than people who don't have a track record. And also, a candidate has to prepare policy initiatives and policy papers. Now, one way around this is you rely on pressure groups or interest groups or lobbying groups. But of course, that can lead to a conflict of interest, perhaps, or accusations of corruption. And you look at some of the sort of people that Obama had to employ to help run his campaign. The famous ones, David Axelrod and David Plouffe and Jim Messina, heading his national campaign. But he also needed early advisors and advisors to help him come up with foreign policy. And there's a huge number of people employed there. And some of them go on to sort of crop up in other guises later on in his administration. People like Susan E. Rice, who would later go on to the UN. And then you'd have to have people to come up with advice and give you things to say, or policy initiatives on energy, on economic policy and domestic policy. You had to pay people like Joe Rospers or Michael Slaby or Macon Phillips or Stephen Geer, who helped with the new media and developing it. And Chris Hughes, developer with Facebook. These are people you have to employ and pay to help you advise your campaign. And so the staffing costs, especially if you're going to need 200 to 500 perhaps in all the key swing states over a year, is going to cost money. So again, that's a crucial aspect to the Get Out the Vote campaign, and it's one of the reasons why presidential election campaigns are costing so much. The last thing for you to consider is just the sheer logistics of it. All the swing states, or even marginal swing states, demand some sort of attention. We see this in the primaries, where candidates are flying repeatedly to Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and we see it in the main presidential campaign, when people are flying repeatedly. Romney did some epic flying in 2012, going to Iowa 6-7 times, then having to fly to New Hampshire, then to Virginia, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Florida, and Florida again, spending hundreds of millions of dollars in each of those states, but also in the travelling. Chartering planes, and it's not just the plane ticket for one. You have to take your staff with you, you have to take up your hair and makeup, you have to have the suits, you have to have the hotel accommodations. And although you might get certain favorable rates for being a campaign, all of this still racks up. You still have to pay for it. Whereas, say, in the UK, most people are only standing for election in their constituency. And while the Prime Minister might travel around the country in some big beasts, they don't have to do the huge number of events that are organised in the same way that American presidential candidates do across a continental landmass, looking at a huge range of people. And, of course, all those events, all those stages, all those rooms, all those halls need to be booked. So, yes, in many ways, American presidential elections are ridiculously expensive. And maybe the campaign finance could be limited. But in many ways, they're not just necessarily spending for spending's sake. It is the nature of American politics. You have to travel to the different states, and that's going to cost money. You have to appear presidential in person, so you have to look good on the media, as the Kennedy debate suggested, and Nixon's problems. Also, that wonderful stat that the last 7 of the last 8 presidential elections have been won with a person with the neatest eyebrows. And the one exception was in 2000, which Gore technically won, or by winning the popular vote. So appearance is important. So you do have to look good and present yourself in the right way. You do have to have policy. So you have to have advisors to give you that policy. Now, when you're president, the government pays for that. It comes out of the taxpayers' money. But before then, it has to come from your own financing. And it's probably good that you have someone who has policies and ideas and a range of people advising them. Yes, the TV advertising is massively expensive. The flip side, the argument is, the free speech argument, it allows you to get your messages out there. And actually, with the exception of 2008 in the main presidential elections, it's been pretty even between the two sides. In 2012, Obama and Romney, if you factor in the super PACs as well, spent roughly the same amount of money in total. So was money the crucial factor? Well, no, it wasn't. Maybe it was how they used that money. Obama getting the better rates on the TV ads, so he got more bang for his buck. The way he used it in computer technology and the Get Out the Vote campaigns. But throughout all this, don't just dismiss the cost of presidential elections as just one criticism. Try and understand why they cost so much money and why that's necessary. And it will then help to explain perhaps why presidential campaigns spend so much time trying to raise so much money. There are ways you could reform the system. You could perhaps make it easier to get on the ballots in different states. You could perhaps limit the amount of TV advertising as you do in the UK, though that might limit the debate, perhaps. You could perhaps say that people are only allowed the same access to technology. There are all ways of limiting it. But at the end of the day, people are going to try and find ways around these rules, as they have done with super PACs and soft money in the past. The costs will keep rising as new ways of getting out the messages and more competitive elections keep coming through. So I hope that's helped explain why American presidential election campaigns cost quite so much money. And I'll be looking at some other issues in the near future. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you got something out of it.